Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, where we get you all caught up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Joining me at the Not-So-Roundtable this Monday morning is Cleveland.com reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Welcome.
Good morning.
Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4. Happy Monday.
Great to be here.
And Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal.
Good morning.
Good morning. Your honeymoon pictures looked lovely, by the way.
Oh, thank
Total
you.
Total side note, Megan just got married a few weeks ago, so congratulations.
Thanks so much. We had a great time in Boston. Saw some Red Sox games.
So let's talk about House Speaker Jason Stevens, because he no longer controls his party's campaign account. A Franklin County judge stripped him of control over ORA, the Ohio House Republicans' campaign cash, and it's the latest twist in the war for control of Ohio's House of Representatives. A war that started last January when Stevens swiped the speakership out from under Republican Derek Marin. Marin had won a provisional ballot, but Stevens worked with Democrats to get a minority of Republicans to get the gavel on opening day. Marin and his group of Republicans have never forgotten it, and they never forgave Stevens, which brings us to this lawsuit. Jeremy, how big of a deal is it for a speaker, any speaker really, to not be in charge of the caucus cash?
It's obviously a big deal, and it's a big deal because it so rarely happens. It's usually taken for granted that if you're the Speaker of the House, you control your own party caucus, and that's not the case here. The reason it's important, the opponents of Jason Stevens really wanted this before the March 19th primary, and that's because this campaign fund spent millions of dollars on behalf of Stevens' favorite candidates, who were being challenged in many cases by Jason Stevens' opponents, and that they didn't get this injunction by then. But the reason this is important is there's not a lot of money in the campaign fund right now. I think they said at the hearing it was like $50,000 to $60,000. But there's under state law, there can only be one campaign fund, and that campaign fund doesn't have these campaign finance limits that most political campaign funds have. So lawmakers can donate unlimited amounts of money to this campaign fund. And so if you have control of that, that makes it much easier to amass a whole bunch of money for the November election that you can spend on your favorite candidates or withhold it. And so we'll see. There's not going to be, under the current districts, a whole lot of competitive races in the Ohio House, but it could determine who gets money and who does not this November.
Megan, money also buys favors, which is why, you know, the head of whatever political party wants to have access to it. So Stevens essentially won't be able to give money to the people whose votes he may be counting on.
That's right. Yes. And we saw in the March primary that even though he was able to give money to his supporters who voted for him for House Speaker, but some were unseated or did not win the primary. And so it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in November's election. But it just goes to show that even though the House Speaker vote took place well over a year ago, we're still seeing this infighting, and it's just teeing up the next year's run for Speaker.
So Natalie, Stevens says he plans to appeal this very quickly. He said it's imperative for the integrity of the institution and said that the campaign committee should not be able to be leveraged against the highest election official in the House on a whim.
I would say it's fairly, I hate to use this word, but I think it's fairly unprecedented, everything that's going on here. We know the court systems aren't necessarily always too fast. I mean, this lawsuit was filed quite a while ago, and we're just getting this decision now. So I can't imagine the appeal, any decision on that will happen too fast. But I think the way the state law is written, it says the person who controls the fund is someone elected by the majority. They had an April 10th meeting, and they elected Phil Plummer to do this. Stevens and his side, they were invited in the court decision. It was pointed out that Stevens knew about the meeting. He got the notice 5 days ahead of time, but decided not to attend. So I think from a law perspective, and I think there's no precedent to reinstate the power to Stevens if we're talking Ohio Revised Code.
Just to make sure, too, this doesn't resolve the lawsuit. This is just an injunction. And one of the things the judge said and the reason he gave the injunction is because he said that it's likely that the overall lawsuit that Stevens' opponents are likely to win on the merits. And if they do, Stevens and one of his top allies, Jeff LaRae, would have to pay nearly $400,000 from themselves in damages. So that's the other wrinkle to this, is the larger lawsuit. And there's, you know, money involved in that, and a significant amount of money.
Yeah, the case is set for trial in late October, which, Natalie, there wouldn't be a ton of money or time left if Stevens were to prevail and get back access to ORA, say, third week of October.
Right, because, you know, then the election happens, all the spending by then, all the ads, all the mailers they're already sent out, it's practically already a done deal by then what kind of money is going to be spent. I think in some ways, the primary election, there was definitely more at stake there than some of the general elections. There's a handful of competitive ones, but in a lot of cases, who is going to be the rep or senator for a certain district was decided in a primary election.
So Derek Maron, the guy who started this all when he was denied, I don't know what the right word is. He won the caucus vote for speaker, but then didn't win the official vote for speaker. But Maron already has the state house in his rearview mirror. He's running against Marcy Kaptur for Congress this fall. But Jeremy, do you think this decision helps Senate President Matt Huffman?
It absolutely does. Any power you can strip from Jason Stevens, obviously money gives you leverage if you're running for speaker, and if you can give money to lawmakers in competitive races, and with an understanding of, hey, if you help me, I'll help you. Now that leverage is gone for Jason Stevens. This is likely to come down to just a few votes. It's going to depend largely on who wins and who loses in November. And if Jason Stevens doesn't have this money, is one of the big, it gets things done, as I think most listeners would agree, around politics.
Yeah. No, but Huffman doesn't have a straightforward path to the speaker seat. A number of other House Republicans from the Maron faction have started to voice their own interest in the top job, Natalie. So we'll see.
Yeah, they're voicing their interest. I think as things stand right now, Stevens and Huffman are the two likely most, you know, competitive at the moment, but things can change at the state house very quickly, as we all know. So it will be interesting to see how that shakes out. The caucus vote will probably happen before the new year, or at least it typically does, but nothing this GA has quite been typical, I suppose. So we'll see how that shakes out. Just because someone wins the caucus vote, you know, things can change between the end of the year and the start of the year when the official vote is taken.
All of this infighting has made this General Assembly one of the least productive in modern history. But it looks like they're going to manage to pass a capital bill this week. Jeremy, no bill is law until the governor signs it, but all signs seem to be pointing towards a deal.
One thing lawmakers can agree on in all parties is that in an election year, when you pass a bill that gives billions of dollars to programs and community projects in your district, that's a good thing, because then when you can go campaign, you can say, hey, look what I brought to you guys personally. And so this is going to be one of the bills that almost guaranteed is going to pass this Wednesday, and then the governor will very likely sign it very soon afterward. It's an enormous bill. I think it's $4.2 billion total. All but $700 million of that is state bond money. And we're talking hundreds of projects. We're talking in Columbus, for example, the Columbus Symphony would get $18.5 million for a new music hall near the Scioto. There's also money, tens of millions of dollars for renovations to the Rifen Rhodes Tower. The Ohio History Connection would get $22 million. On and on and on and on. There's just a lot in here.
Yeah, down in Cincinnati, there's a convention center and a tennis tournament that are going to get a ton of money. There's like $600 million for school buildings, $72 million for state parks, lodges and cabins. There's a little bit for everybody to love, right, Megan?
That's right. Even the fair is included. Governor
DeWine. That's coming up soon.
Yes, Governor DeWine is a big fan of the fair, and so there are there's money going towards the fairgrounds as well for renovations and updates. So yes, a little bit for everyone, all corners of the state.
There's also an emergency clause attached to the bill as it stands right now. So as soon as the governor signs it, the money will go out and the projects will start whenever the money's there.
Jeremy, I want to circle back to that $700 million. That's special extra money on top, the super duper fund, as super it's been called. Fund. And that seems to have been a real point of contention. And the way they finally compromised was to essentially split this special pot of money into $350 million for the House and $350 million for the Senate.
Yeah, for the past 3 years, the state has been flush with money, done really well, partially because of coronavirus funding from the feds and partially because tax revenues have been higher than expected. So last year, they ended with $700 million in all this unexpected tax revenue. So what are we going to do with that?
Spend it.
More than that. you could argue about whether a tax reduction is spending or not, but either way, they decided we're going to put it towards, one, a sales tax holiday that will take effect, an expanded sales tax holiday that'll take effect the first week of August. And then secondly, they're giving $700 million of this surplus, quote unquote, tax revenue to these one-time projects. And this is coming at a time, of course, when state revenues now, it seems the party's over, that state tax revenues are coming in lower than expected. But that's going to make a difference in next year's normal operating budget more than it's going to make a difference now with the capital budget.
I did want to ask about that because income tax revenues are down. Essentially, we're bringing in less money than we thought.
Correct. And also state coronavirus money from the feds, that's ending too. So in the past couple of budget cycles, lawmakers have had to make really easy decisions like, hey, we have all this money. What can we do with it? And now they're going to have a lot more tough decisions to make next year, especially as they've come out with all these spending plans on things, everything from school vouchers to getting rid of the income tax to child care, affordable housing. There's all these spending plans and they're going to have to make tough decisions about what to do.
Before we head to our first break, I want to quickly talk about cannabis. So the Division of Cannabis Control has awarded dozens of provisional licenses to existing medical marijuana dispensaries in Columbus, Cincinnati, Akron. When do we think they're going to open?
Soon, to be determined.
To be determined
the exact date, but there's still some hoops to jump through. They have to go through, I believe it's a test to show that the employees are able to demonstrate the difference between the medical use and the adult use. So there's still some hoops to jump through. It sounds like there's not going to be like an official like grand opening like on this date in particular, but I would expect it to be in the coming weeks.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be dispensary by dispensary, right, Natalie? Instead of like one day, all of them open all at once.
Yeah, I think, you know, when they get their certain approvals and jump through their hoops, they'll be able to start opening slowly but surely. Definitely ahead of the timeline, though, as it was prescribed in the state law, it had to happen, like licenses had to be distributed by September, early September, but now we're in mid-June. So definitely.
I was kind of surprised it was a couple of months ahead of schedule, but
yeah.
Also, state officials are reminding people not to operate their boats while high. This will mark the first summer with recreational marijuana after voters legalized it. So, you know, in addition to don't drink and drive, don't smoke and boat.
Correct. And there's also been in nearly every legislature a proposal to allow boaters to not have a second person in the boat if they install rear view mirrors if they're someone water skiing. It's not surprising. There's been an unusual focus in the legislature on boat safety. I don't think that's a bad thing, but it's been just more an important focus of theirs. And so it makes sense that one of the first things they turn to is, hey, if you get high, don't drive a boat in an unsafe way.
It's common sense.
Yeah, one would think. That was Megan Henry from the Ohio Capital Journal. Coming up, where abortion in Ohio stands 2 years after the Supreme Court struck down federal protections. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4, and Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. 2 years ago, the conservative majority on the Supreme Court overturned the landmark case of Roe v. Wade. The Dobbs decision ended 50 years of federal abortion protections, returning the power to determine its legality to the states. Megan, a lot has happened in those 2 years. Ohio added legal protections for most abortions into our state's constitution, but that didn't mean the laws on our books disappeared. So where does the heartbeat bill, signed by Governor Mike DeWine in 2019, stand today?
Yes, Ohio has had quite a bit of change in the past 2 years with abortion being banned initially with the heartbeat bill, and then with the law that was already on the books, and then with issue one passing in November. I'm going to pass it off to Jeremy and Natalie to talk about the heartbeat bill.
So still tied up in court, the question now is whether that law can be upheld given the new constitutional amendment, which protects the right to an abortion up to the point of fetal viability. That's what's currently in the state's constitution. Typically, the constitution, what's written in there, trumps all state laws. It's higher than the Ohio Revised Code. So lawmakers can't go and reverse it. The only way you can change it is through another ballot initiative. But there's some question now about whether, you know, the constitutional amendment was too vague. And by question, I mean for people like Attorney General Dave Yost, who say there are some things that are a little subtle in the constitutional amendment, some things that might be vague. There are some things that we can still challenge and push back on. So I'm not sure this conversation will ever truly end, but yeah, still held up, still being litigated.
Same with mandatory waiting periods for abortions, ban on using telemedicine for abortion consultations, ban on abortions after a diagnosis of Down syndrome. We have a lot of abortion laws, Jeremy.
And I'm going to keep beating the drum that's why probably the most important race other than the Senate race in Ohio this year, these three Supreme Court races, Ohio Supreme Court races, because it will eventually be up to the state Supreme Court to interpret what exactly the new constitutional amendment means for all those dozens of laws, some of which you just said. And so what's riding on this is whether the Supreme Court will be a 4-3 Democratic majority, or it could be a 5-2 Republican majority. And so it's really important that people pay attention to that, because that will, more than any state Supreme Court race in decades, this will matter a whole lot.
Now, state lawmakers could take these laws off the books, but it is a Republican supermajority, so Natalie, I'm not holding my breath.
I don't think the laws will be taken off the books. I think it's going to be, well, kind of, we'll wait and see. Oh, we have the constitutional amendment. Like, it doesn't really matter at this point. It's a moot point. So there's a lot of different arguments on that. I think, for all intents and purposes, nothing can be done to fully affect the constitutional amendment, but I don't think the questions are going to stop being asked about how we can get around certain things.
We're going to move on to the next topic, but Wednesday's show is going to be all about abortion here in Ohio 2 years post-Dobbs. We're going to talk about the abortion pill, the recent vote against IVF by the Southern Baptist Convention, and more. So Wednesday, 10 a.m., if you want to go even deeper on what it means 2 years post-Dobbs. And, you know, we don't usually talk about national politics on our reporter roundtable, but I do want to remind everyone that the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to decide another landmark case very soon. The decision on whether former President Donald Trump deserves immunity for alleged crimes he committed while in office. The decision is expected sometime this week, and we here at WOSU are going to take NPR National when that decision comes down. But while we wait, the former president was back in Ohio last week for a fundraiser with Senator J.D. Vance. Jeremy, how much money are you putting on our junior senator becoming his vice presidential pick?
I think he's definitely in the conversation. And if he doesn't get the vice presidential nominee, he's going to have a strong, at least possible, role in the Trump administration should the former president win. One reason, of course, is that Ohio is a pretty reliably Republican state. And if Senator Vance does leave the Senate, Mike DeWine can appoint his replacement. And it's I mean, Sherrod Brown would differ with this, but it's more likely than not that a Republican will win a U.S. Senate race here. So J.D. Vance has a lot going for him. He's clearly been angling for it. He's been very effusive in his praise of former President Trump. And you have to, I think Tim Scott, a senator from West Virginia, from South Carolina, I beg your pardon, and a few others have been mentioned, but J.D. Vance is right up there.
I know. It's so strange. I feel like he's more serious than the conversation was about Sherrod Brown for Hillary Clinton or Rob Portman, like for Mitt Romney.
Yeah, there's these leaks, you know, that reporters, national reporters, kind of get off the record hints about what Trump is thinking. And all those leaks are indicating that J.D. Vance is right up there.
Mm-hmm. And J.D. Vance, he wasn't always a supporter of Trump, but now he staunchly is. And so I think Trump likes to demonstrate and hold him up as an example of someone
supports
him now. Exactly. He convinced. So I think that is something that is unique about J.D. Vance and Donald Trump.
J.D. Vance is also, you know, one of those political outsiders. He's like Trump. He's a businessman turned, you know, politician. So I think that's also an interesting angle. And J.D. Vance is really popular in Ohio, but so is Trump. So it will be interesting to see how Vance on the ticket, if it is him, plays out across the country as well, not just in Ohio. I mean, we know he's popular in Ohio and Ohioans obviously elected him, but will it help Trump in other states? I think that will be really interesting.
And speaking of Donald Trump speaking of support for Donald Trump, an elected official in Lincoln County made news last week for flying an upside-down American flag. Etna Township trustee Rosalind McKee used the Alito defense, saying it was her husband who hung the flag, not her. Megan, why do you think stories about upside-down flags get so much attention these days? Is it just because of the Samuel Alito question?
I think that's part of it. I think, too, we're just living in a time of such divisiveness in politics. And so things like that get people's attention. It does raise questions of, like, well, why is this? People see headlines with that. And so it does just raise these questions. So it's interesting that is what she is saying, that, oh, it was my spouse that did that. But does that mean that you're absolved of all responsibility? It's your house as well. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I do find it interesting that the explanation in both cases for the U.S. Supreme Court justice and for this township trustee was my spouse did it, not me.
That's been a time-honored excuse given by many, many political figures about why something, when they come under criticism, that, hey, you know, I didn't have anything to do with it. You know, it was my spouse. Which, you know, may or may not be true, but that's certainly not the first time a political figure has made that sort of statement.
Yeah. I don't know. My husband and I own both our cars, but he knows better than to put, like, a political bumper sticker on it, you know, because, I don't know, not my monkey, not my marriage, do not know how they work.
Yeah, I don't know the dynamics there. You know, that's a different kind of politics within a family.
And before we veer back to state house politics, I also want to ask you all what you'll be watching for Thursday night. That's the first presidential debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. J.D. Vance, do you think Vance? J.D. Vance, Jeremy, do you think J.D. Vance will be doing spin for the former president after it's over?
I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't doubt it at all. You know, Senator Vance went to Trump's trial in New York to give him support. You know, he's been, again, very effusive in his support of Trump, so I wouldn't doubt at all that he was in the spin room afterward. As far as the debate itself, you know, we're not back
it's
in 2020.
So early.
It's so early, but also in 2020, like, we had people had debates, and it didn't really change anyone's mind, and even less now. Most of the country knows exactly how they're going to vote, and I think the debate is really meant to help bolster and nail down people's preconceived notions of who they want to vote for, and they also hope that the other person just makes a major screw-up that they can exploit.
I think much of the country knows who they're going to vote for, but I think a lot of people, too, just anecdotally in conversations I've had, are like, I don't know what to do here. Biden's not doing it for me. Trump's not doing it for me. So I'm, you know, there might be a good number of undecided voters. Not that debates are necessarily the most helpful indicator in swaying people, but, you know, I think, like Jeremy said, if one of them has some sort of major flub up or something like that, it might make the difference between a handful of voters.
Yeah, if somebody has concerns about either man's age, this could be give them a reason to vote for them or maybe give them a reason not. Mm-hmm. All right, back to state politics. Governor Mike DeWine is expected to sign a law giving people with criminal records another path to stable housing. Natalie, how is this going to work?
So he did sign the law on Friday. It will go into effect in about 90 days now. What this will do is it will say if you've been out of prison for a year, you can go to the court in which you got sentenced and you can say, hey, I want to apply for this thing called a CQH, which is a certificate of it's a housing certificate, essentially. I don't exactly remember what CQH stands for, but you can go and you can apply for it. If the judge grants it to you, you can take it to a landlord and you can say, look, I have this CQH. Will you rent to me? And if they say yes, that landlord gets immunity. Immunity if, you know, that person, like the way Bill Sites put it, Majority Floor Leader Bill Sites, he said, if they terrorize the neighbors or if they make another mistake or something like that, the landlord can't be sued for it. It's based off a law that went into effect in 2012 or somewhat modeled off. It was called the CQE, which had to do with employment to give employers immunity. So it will be interesting to see, you know, how many people apply for this. The thing about it is it's pretty subjective. There's no exact, like, you know, checklist of things that you have to meet in order for the judge to grant you the CQH. So, you know, we have 88 different counties, a bunch of different judges across the state. It'll be interesting to see how it's applied, but essentially it's immunity in turn for housing.
It basically incentivizes landlords to rent to someone they might otherwise see as too risky.
I might not say incentivize, only because the only thing that's in it for them, I guess,
is immunity.
Yeah, they're not getting like some sort of like
it takes away the concern or maybe some of the concern. Yeah. You also spoke to a woman named Andrea Henderson. Can you share a little bit about what she told you? Because I thought it was really compelling about how difficult it can be to get housing after leaving prison.
So she's been out of prison for 10 years now for a white collar crime. She got out of prison, got a job that she was in for 3 years, and then she joined the union. Since being in the union, she's worked her way up, is now a journeyman, says she's the foreman on some projects, but still absolutely cannot find housing. She said when she first got out of prison, she was basically couch surfing, asking friends and family, getting into relationships so she could have a place to stay. She said that was really hard on her mental health. Now, you know, she's been out of prison for 10 years. She's been clean. She's had a stable job, but no one will rent to her because she has to check that felony box. So she's staying in a long-term hotel now instead of being able to rent a place to stay. She says she thinks this law is going to be a step in the right direction, but essentially was like, I'm not sure how much this is really going to help me. They still don't have to rent to me. And if they're comparing two applications in mine, even if it comes with this CQH and someone else doesn't have a felony, even though I've been out of prison for 10 years and clean, I think my odds are still pretty low to get housing.
Yeah, I think it goes to the housing crisis we're having here in Central Ohio in particular. If you have a dozen applicants, you can be pretty darn choosy.
This is a merger of two issues that traditionally are Democratic issues, but an increasing number of legislative Republicans care about. One is affordable housing, as you said, given the housing crisis in the state. The other is criminal justice reform. The Republican-dominated legislatures passed a number of bills making sure that when people get out of prison, they are able to do things like find jobs, have a bank account, put their life back together. And this is a convergence of those two things. And I'm not surprised it passed at all.
Megan, let's talk about LifeWise Academy. So can you explain what it is and how it works with public schools?
Yes. Yeah, so LifeWise Academy, it's headquartered in Ohio. And so basically public schools, gives them a chance to have a policy in place at their school, at their school district, for students, public school students, to then go to LifeWise Academy, which is an off-campus site, either bus or walk. And so they will miss part of the school day, either a class or lunch or recess, and then they receive religious learning. So the LifeWise Academy is a Christian institute, so they receive Bible teachings, essentially, and then they will return to class. And you need the student's permission and the parent's permission in order to do so. But some lawmakers want to change the policy in Ohio so that school districts don't have to, that they may make a policy, but some that the districts will have to make a policy. So basically just bolstering that up, because some school districts have denied LifeWise being able to have a relationship with a school district. So basically it would just allow more school districts to opt into this religious release time. And the legislation, it would not just be Christian institutions. It would be any religion. So LifeWise is just the well-known Christian institution.
So essentially, it's a temporary dismissal once or twice a week for religious education.
Essentially so. And I think part of the reason this sparked is it's literally just changes one word in state law, like Megan said, from may to shall. And there were some school districts here in Central Ohio, for example, that had a policy on their book, and then parents wanted to use it. And the school said, no, we have to rescind this policy. And their arguments, the school board say, you know, we don't get the students for that many hours in a school year. We don't have the time for this. Every hour is needed. So I think that's part of the reason it sparked, because some school districts are either rescinding their policies or actually not letting them go into place, because most school districts across the state do have a policy. It's just little used.
Yeah, you spoke with a family who supports the idea of required release for these programs, and I'm going to play a clip from that interview. This is Caleb Reed, a seventh grader who wants this religious release.
I feel like it would help me affirm my beliefs, and it would help everyone else with that same thing and their mental health. I have too many things competing for after-school programs, so I can't do those, and I want a release time program.
So, Natalie, Caleb's school recently voted against letting LifeWise in, citing those concerns that, look, why not do it in the afternoons, weekends? What happened to Sunday school, essentially?
Pretty much, and I think the argument that parents and students are making now is that we have too many after-school activities, homework, things like that. Why not give them an hour out of the week during their lunch or their recess or a free period to go receive this religious instruction, so that way we don't have to worry about it on days that we otherwise have things going on?
And to the students who miss school, they are responsible for making up the classwork that they might have missed as well. So it is adding an extra burden, so to speak, like on the students.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of think kids are overscheduled anyway, but that's neither here nor there. This is not the parenting podcast, so we will move right along and take a quick break. When we get back, how a lawyer who flung a Pringle can of his own feces got his law license back. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staber. Still with us is Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Natalie Fahmy, statehouse reporter for NBC4, and Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. It's no secret here in Ohio that Attorney General Dave Yost has interest in a larger office in 2026, but he's also the guy prosecuting House Bill 6 indictments. That's the nuclear bailout scandal that ensnared former House Speaker Larry Householder and sent him to federal prison for 20 years. When asked whether Yost's desire to be our next governor could get in the way of the prosecution, here's what he had to say.
I'm not directing it, and it was very important to me to make sure that the reputation of the office, and more importantly, that investigation proceeded along with any appropriate court cases without any question about motivation or politics. This is about the law.
So, Natalie, the question comes up because Lieutenant Governor John Husted could be a witness for the prosecution in this case, and John Husted could also be a candidate for governor in 2026.
That's right. There are still a lot of moving pieces in this House Bill 6 scandal. So the question is now, you know, how is Dave Yost going to handle both prosecuting for the scandal and bringing forward indictments and witnesses, questioning, and not make it look like it's politically motivated at all? So he said he wants there to be absolutely no question that there's any motivation or political motivation behind the decisions he makes. That's why he has stepped aside from this. So it will be interesting to see how things play out. I think, you know, him stepping aside could foreshadow more things to come, more things to unfold, I'll say.
Yeah, because, Jeremy, the prosecution that we're talking about is First Energy executives, right? Chuck Jones and Mike Dowling. They've been charged at the state level. And it is a question of what they said to the governor and the lieutenant governor, what they knew, when they knew it. The top two elected officials in the state of Ohio could provide, potentially provide, crucial testimony in their prosecution.
Potentially. So there's no guarantee that DeWine or Husted are going to actually end up testifying there.
And there's been no allegation that they're going to be criminally charged in any way.
Correct. Yeah. Not so far. But there's been a treasure trove of emails and text messages released in the past few weeks showing the close working relationship that DeWine and Husted had with former First Energy executives in to get House Bill 6 passed. That, you know, not to mention that they communicated about DeWine helping to arrange a $500,000 dark money payment to a group working to help DeWine back in 2018 before House Bill 6. So there's legal ramifications. And as you said, there's no sign yet that DeWine and Husted would be criminally charged with anything. But then there's the political ramifications. And as soon as you get wrapped up in this, it just has a taint on you, whether it is illegal or not, that could hurt John Husted in his 2026 race for governor.
So let's move on to the Senate's higher education bill. This feels like the bill, Natalie, that just won't die. Like, it's been on life support for a solid couple of months. And for those who don't remember this bill, it's Senate Bill 83. It is the one that would change so much about how our public colleges and universities operate. It would get rid of mandatory DEI trainings, change how professors are evaluated, but it would no longer block them from striking. So it's had a lot of changes, too.
It has had a lot of changes. I think life support is a perfect way to put it. Yeah, there have been a lot of concessions made in this bill from its original form. Hundreds of faculty members, students have come out and testified to the State House against this bill. And, you know, a few months ago, Senate President Matt Huffman said, if the House doesn't pass it with all the concessions we've made now, we'll just pass it next GA and we will not make quite as many concessions. But I think the latest development in this now is that some House members have circulated a letter to other representatives, because the only thing standing in the way of this and the governor's desk is a House floor vote, essentially, right now. So they've circulated a letter and they've said, sign this if you are supportive of it. Not sure how many signatures are on that letter at this given moment, but if there are enough to pass the bill, it will be interesting to see whether Speaker Stevens brings it to the floor or not. Vote counting is hard at the State House. You never really know until you know and you take the vote. But we could see it move forward this week.
Yeah. And to be clear, this letter is not a discharge petition. And that is an official request that Stevens couldn't ignore if it had a majority of signatures.
Yeah, exactly. This is just a letter that some reps are saying, hey, we want to know whether or not we have the votes. Let's stop arguing about it. Let's get pen to paper. Let's say up or down and get this done.
Yeah, Megan, the governor's even said he thinks he'll get to sign it before the end of the year. So hope springs eternal.
That's right. Yes, Governor DeWine has said recently that if the bill continues to undergo some changes, that he would envision signing it when asked what changes he would like to see with the bill that's already been changed about 11 times with various revisions, major revisions, that is. He did not elaborate, but it does sound like he would support a version of the bill and sign it. So curious to see what will happen on Wednesday. Speaker Stevens, yes, has been hesitant to bring it to the floor. And every time we ask him about it, he just kind of deflects it. So we shall see what happens.
Yeah, Speaker Stevens has been the only thing between this bill being brought up and becoming law. It's really Jason Stevens who is the reason this bill hasn't been signed into law so far. I'm a little puzzled about why he would hold it for months and then suddenly either allow the bill to move by itself or more likely would be dumped into another bill that they would pass. And I would be interested to see the reasoning for that. But it's really Jason Stevens that they have to win over. And you know, the scuttlebutt is they might win him over for reasons that remain to be seen.
Yeah, he could also be holding it for lame duck as sort of a negotiating tool. Like, I have something you really want, give me something I really want.
You know, there's when you have this something this competitive, you know, they're not afraid to hold hostages sometimes.
I want to talk about cameras in patient rooms. So there's a bill sponsored by Representative Sarah Carruthers of Hamilton that would allow families to put cameras in facilities that care for people with developmental disabilities. The idea being that having a camera in the room could prevent abuse or neglect. It would be called Lauren's Law. And so I want to know, who is Lauren and how did she inspire this bill? Don't all answer at once.
Lauren, if I remember correctly, she was in a developmental disability center, I believe, in the Cincinnati area.
It's in Fairfield.
In Fairfield, yeah. Thank you. And she had some, if I remember correctly, some bruisings. I remember there was like a gash, a deep cut on her throat, and her father was the one who questioned, you know, how is this happening? Where is this coming about? And so he tried to put a camera in her room, similar to Esther's Law, which allows you to put a camera in a nursing home room for a loved one, as long as you get the roommate, if there's a roommate, their permission as well. And so he tried to do something similar for his daughter, and the center removed it, said you could not do that. And then they evicted her shortly after, and basically sounds like some centers up in the Toledo area, and I believe Cleveland said that they would be able to take her in, but they live in Cincinnati and the dad wants to be able to go and visit his daughter and see her on a regular basis. So that is what sparked this. It's basically similar to Esther's Law, protections for developmentally disabled folks in centers.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, right? Because you have that same question with certain kinds of elderly patients, particularly those with Alzheimer's or dementia. It's a question of whether they can tell you what's going wrong, essentially.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there's a lot that could potentially happen. And so that's what sparked Esther's Law back over a decade ago. And that took quite a while to pass, if I remember correctly, several conversations back and forth. So, yes, lots there that people want to know what's going on in residential facilities, especially I think after COVID when people weren't able to go visit their loved ones. I think that has kind of renewed that interest as well.
Yeah, I would think, particularly because there was a lot of deaths in nursing homes during COVID and there was questions about what was happening.
And DeWine released a tool a few months ago for, you know, for families to know whether or not nursing homes have high ratings, where they stand, things like that. So it seems like there's some work being done around the whole idea of accountability in nursing homes and...
Yeah, and there was more money for those that did well, and there were harsher penalties for those that weren't doing well. I remember that. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it was called the Nursing Home Navigator. It had sort of alliterative
like
name.
Yeah.
On the one hand, this might seem to many listeners as something like, oh, of course, we should definitely have this. And the fact that lawmakers passed a similar bill, like Megan said, regarding nursing homes, it might seem like this is kind of a slam dunk. However, you have to understand, too, that the nursing home lobby is pretty powerful. They make objections, you know, about what this would do to patient care and for their facilities. And also that this bill was brought in April. It's kind of late in the legislative session, and they don't have, especially like this Wednesday is going to be the last session for the House and Senate for months. And so they might just run out of time before this, and then they have to reintroduce the next session if it's brought back.
And Carruthers, who introduced the bill, she lost her primary.
Oh, right. So she'll be leaving at the end of the year as well. Well, we'll have to wait and see. Megan, I did want to quickly touch on a new program for students here. Ohio is one of more than 30 states that has opted into the SunBucks program to help feed hungry students this summer. Can you tell us how the program works? Because I understand the benefits start July 31st.
Yes, that's correct. So summer can be the hungriest time of year for students who rely on free and reduced breakfast and lunches at school. And so basically, SunBucks is a program that would give families $120 per student. So they could have a couple students who are eligible, and so they could receive $120 per student. But they receive the money by the end of July, so towards the end of the summer. When asked about that, the program administrator basically had said that since it's a new program, had a little bit of getting off the ground. So hopefully next year is the hope that they can have it sooner. But the idea is that family can go to the grocery store and buy the produce that they want instead of just showing up to a library or a community center that has a lunch or a meal provided, which is great, but then they have a little more freedom in choosing what they want. And so some families are automatically enrolled. If you receive SNAP benefits or if you receive those free and reduced lunches, you probably are already automatically enrolled, but still be good to check as well.
Yeah, because you don't think about it always, but if your kid gets free lunch every day and free breakfast every day at school, those are two meals a day that they're no longer getting, and you have to now cover the cost for the summer.
That's right. And this program, too, it's supposed to be in tandem with those community center lunches and library lunches that you can go to as well. So it's not a one or the other. It's just supposed to be in tandem to help those support those families.
And finally, the defense attorney who flung a can of Pringles filled with his own feces has his law license back. Jeremy, first things first, what can you remind all of us what the heck this was all about and why this behavior didn't get him permanently disbarred?
So in 2021, Jake Blakesley, he's from Noble County, he threw a Pringles can of his own poop into the parking lot of the county's Crime Victim Advocacy Center. And then he drove to a court hearing where he was representing a client who could have faced the death penalty. And the Crime Victim Advocacy Center CEO had an interest in that case, you know, showed up to a bunch of hearings. And, you know, he, as a result, he lost his law license and back in November. And he admitted that he had done this at least 10 times previously. And he said it was kind of a release for him to do it. He said he didn't know exactly why he did it.
A release in many ways.
Sorry,
I couldn't help myself.
And so they said, okay, Supreme Court said, you're going to lose your law license for a year. But if you don't do anything wrong and you don't have any further misconduct, we're going to allow you to petition for your law license in 6 months. 6 months have passed. He petitioned. He didn't do anything wrong. He's met all his requirements. And so now he has his law license back.
It feels very strange to me. I don't know. The idea that pooping in a chip can and flinging it at somebody who has irked you isn't enough for a permanent disqualification. But, I mean, look, I am not the Ohio State Bar. This is not my job to decide. It just, I'm not really sure what gets you disbarred permanently.
It's funny because the Supreme Court noted there are very few precedents for this.
There isn't a lot of case precedent for this. That's probably a good thing.
I guess there was a case in Oklahoma that was kind of similar to this, but, you know, this is kind of a first,
Oklahoma?
And it might be precedent that other poop-filled Pringles can cases in the future will dictate what happens.
Oh, my goodness. Megan, you also had a story about an Ohio bill that would make it easier to seal nonviolent records. So how do advocates want that expanded?
Yes, they want it expanded to include felony convictions. So right now, if you have a felony, it is harder to get that sealed. And so they, which in turn will make it harder to get a job. And so this bill is trying to make it just easier for formerly incarcerated folks to get jobs and be employed when they get out of prison after serving time. So this bill would automatically seal quite a few of those records. But however, advocates want more felonies to be included to have them be able to get jobs.
And it sounds like the qualifier there is that they be nonviolent, correct?
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
And I think what's really interesting about bills like this, too, is it plays into this whole workforce crisis that the state's having, where we have too many jobs and not enough people to fill them. So
that was Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And thank you to Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal.
Great to be here.
And thank you to Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com.
Thanks so much, Anna.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.